Cool. Welcome again to this new Beer and Tech. Today we have the pleasure to have a special guest with Blaise Vignon, CPO from Alice and Bob, to talk about quantum computing. So unknown topic for me. To start this discussion and this talk, Blaise have some slide to share with you. So Blaise, I'll let you share your screen to start on that. And before digging into the topic of today, as usual, a quick presentation of our special guest. So Blaise, I met Blaise at Criteo. You were head of product at Criteo, and then several other product position for Google Drive, and now you are CPO for Alice and Bob, a Parisian startup. Correct. The classic question, Blaise, we ask during a beer tech is, what is your favorite beer?
So I know you're asking this question all the time, and it's kind of hard to tell, and I really wanted to go for something, you know, I didn't want to feel too snobby and come up with something that nobody could buy. And I didn't want to go for the classical IPA either. So I went for the Brasserie du Mont Blanc. I'm not sure if you had any guests mention this one yet.
Nope, not yet.
So I discovered this beer for the first time maybe 15 years ago, after a hike in the Mont Blanc Massif. And it's a very light beer, and it's easy to drink. It's very good for after hikes. It's not a craft beer. You can actually buy it in supermarket. You find it fairly easily. Now, there are several flavors. This one is a purple one, which is very nice, very light. So it's not one of these very strong IPAs with very strong flavor. It's a summer beer for when you go hiking with family. And yeah, you can buy it. Typically, you find it in most supermarkets. So I recommend you try it. And the opening system is also very fun.
Okay, right. So cool. Let's now move to the topic of today. So Blaise, I give you the floor, and as usual, after that, you will have everyone the Q&A to ask any question you could have during and after this presentation.
Yes, thank you. So I'm going to talk about quantum computing. I didn't know anything about quantum computing 18 months ago before I joined Alice and Bob. And so I think it's only fair to say a word about my employer, Alice and Bob, because and you're gonna see during this talk, there is a lot that can be said about quantum computing. It could fill hours and hours of talk, and obviously in this talk I decided to take a very much Alice and Bob angle, and so it makes sense for you to know where I'm talking from. Alice and Bob is a French startup. It's based in Paris. We can see the Eiffel Tower from the window where I am. It's right in front of the Ministère des Armées, for people who know Paris, in the 15th. It was founded 3 years ago by Theo and Raph, both physicists, brilliant physicists, and they met during their PhD thesis. And they were working on this strange object during their PhD thesis called a cat qubit. So cat, like a cat, meow. And qubits as the smallest way to store quantum information. So the cat qubit is an object that can store quantum information. And so they were working on this cat qubit, and they figured, well, this cat qubit is actually very interesting. I'm pretty sure we could build a very interesting quantum computer out of it. And so they decided to start a company to do just that. The company today is 70 employees. The most amazing statistics about this 70 employees is that either half of them have either a PhD or are working towards a PhD. It's a very, you know, research-heavy company. It's filing patents at a very nice clip, and it's actually privately funded, 30 million raised about 18 months ago. But it's also very close to the public research. It's very close to the academic labs. Especially where Theo and Raph started, which are ENS, Polytechnique in Ria, CEA, so all the, you know, top French research. So it's and that's something I'd like to say about quantum in general, quantum in France in particular. The quantum in France is very close to academia, and that's something different for people who've been in the game long enough remember the big data wave and the AI wave and maybe the internet wave, where basically the entrepreneurship was very disconnected from academia, and that maybe hurt a little bit French innovation. In quantum, that's not happening. Academia is very much playing a leading role in terms of stewarding these companies towards success. So that's something very different from the other technological way we've seen before. As I said, we were founded 3 years ago, and by some measure, we can say we are the leaders of quantum computing. We're a leader in this category, which is fault-tolerant universal, which I'm going to talk a little bit about. So that's Titan Lab in a nutshell. It's a fascinating company. I'll talk more about it later. But before I do that, maybe a little bit of some words about why would anyone want to build a quantum computer? And the reason we want to build a quantum computer is because we want to solve problems that cannot be solved otherwise. And so what is it about quantum computers that make it possible to solve problems that cannot be solved otherwise? The main thing to understand is that in a quantum computer, the information is not a bit, so it's not zero and one. It's what's called a qubit. And the best way to think of a qubit is to think not of a zero or one, but as a point on a sphere. And the power of being a point on a sphere is then you have this superposition of states, and that's very powerful when it comes to computation. So you can compute a superposition of states, and you can have these algorithms that take advantage of this superposition. But it's also a pain in the ass, quite frankly, because if you have a zero or one, the only error you can have is it becomes a one or a zero, right? You flip the bit. But if you are on a sphere, you can also wander around the sphere, like on an east-west direction. And so basically what I'm trying to say here is that this quantum information stored on this qubit is very powerful, but it's also very fragile. And so we're going to see about this power and this fragility. So why is it very powerful? Well, if you're in classical computing, there's pretty much only one gate that matters, which is a NAND gate, or you can also use a NOR gate. If you have a NAND gate or a NOR gate, you can build any truth table you want. You can build any truth table you want. But in quantum computing, because these qubits exist, and also because these qubits can also be entangled, so basically they share a mathematical state, the catalog of gates you can build is much richer. It's much more complex. And so that means that there is a class of algorithm that is attached to these gates that's new, that's not accessible with the classical computing. It's very hard to understand the mathematics of it. Actually, the researchers are still fighting to understand the mathematics of it. Nobody really understands them. But the truth of the matter is quantum computing just allows humanity to think about richer algorithms. And so what's the promise? Well, some of these richer algorithms, and there are not that many of these algorithms. There are a few. Depending on how you count, there are maybe 5, maybe 20, maybe 100. But these algorithms, they have a promise, which is they will get humanities to solutions exponentially faster. The most well-known example of that is finding prime factors in an integer. Finding prime factors in an integer, for people who are technically inclined, you might know that it's very relevant to cryptanalysis, to code cracking. So there is this code that's called RSA, which secures most of the internet today. And if you could factor numbers quickly, then you could crack RSA. And there is an algorithm that's known in quantum that is exponentially faster than the classical algorithm. And so if we had a quantum computer, we know we could crack RSA in a matter of hours. So the good news is we don't have a quantum computer, but if we did, we know we could crack RSA in a matter of hours. And this promise here is called quantum advantage. And actually, there are several can solve quantum advantage. Everybody's looking for this practical quantum advantage, which is kind of like cracking RSA. But there's also maybe an energy advantage, an energetic quantum advantage, which is maybe you don't get much faster into solving some algorithms, but maybe your quantum computing machine gives you an energetic advantage. It's cheaper in terms of watts spent to crack some algorithms. And as I said, there's not that many algorithms that are relevant for quantum. But those algorithms that could bring a quantum advantage are very, very powerful in terms of the value they can unlock. So one area where we think you can create a lot of value is what's called simulation. And what I mean here by simulation is something very, very specific, is chemistry simulation. How can you simulate molecules? Today, we know exactly how molecules work. Basically, they work using the quantum equations of nature, Schrödinger equation, but they are very hard to simulate because the systems are very, very complex. But we know if we had a quantum algorithm, quantum computer, we would be able to simulate molecules, and then we could unlock, you know, billions of value in terms of research, research that's relevant for batteries or fertilizers, drug design, stuff like that. And you have a similar story for anything about optimization, so logistics, finance, everything. A similar story was, again, for anything around matrix manipulation, and especially machine learning. And I already talked about cryptography. So as I said, not that many algorithms, but those algorithms are linked to a very high value. Everybody is very motivated to build a quantum algorithm, quantum computer. Especially the cryptographic use case, they mean that there's a lot of national interest by all countries to build a quantum algorithm, quantum computer. And so now the question is, how do you actually build a quantum computer? So that's what we do. And there are many ways you can think of building a quantum computer. Basically, it all boils down to what kind of qubit are you basing your quantum computer on? And pretty much you can use as a qubit any object that can store quantum information, any object that behaves in a quantum manner. Some people use spins, so electron spin. Spin is a value that you can attach to a quantum object, and you know it can behave quantically. Some people use photons. There is a French startup called Candela who has had very good results using photons. Some people use ions. Some people use atoms. There's the most famous French startup in quantum is called Pascal, and basically for Pascal, a qubit is an atom trapped into a laser beam, and they can trap, you know, hundreds of atoms, and each atom is a qubit. And if you want to do gates, you interact with the atoms with the laser beams. It's pretty amazing. And some people use superconducting circuits. That's what we do. Superconducting circuits is actually the most popular form right now of quantum computing research. It's about half the investment. It's the area that's been chosen by Google, by Amazon, by IBM, and also by Alison Baum. And the idea of superconducting circuits is basically you have this, I'm gonna try and find a pointer right there. You have this circuit here, and it may be hard to see, but this is an actual electric circuit, and it's this circuit is a layer of metal. In this case, this metal is tantalum, and it's deposited on a layer of glass. In this case, the glass is sapphire, and this circuit is fabricated. We fabricate the circuits in clean rooms that we have contracts for, and you know we fabricate these circuits on a regular basis. We fabricate a couple tens of them every week, and we mount them into these sample holders, and then as I said, the circuits are superconducting circuits. And the thing about aluminum and tantalum is they are superconducting at 0.10 Kelvin, 0.0 1 Kelvin, 10 millikelvin. So if you know the absolute zero, that's a tenth of a degree above the absolute zero. To give an idea of scale, if you go to outer space, that's 4 Kelvin. So this is, in a way, this is like 40 times cooler than space. And to cool to 10 millikelvins, we use this fridges here. So this one is open. Basically, this chip here goes into the fridge here, right there. And then it's connected by this cable to the outside of the fridge. And here there's a bunch of cooling stages. So we start with nitrogen, and then we have helium that enable us to go to 10 millikelvin. And as I said, there's these signals coming out here. Sorry. And then the signals go back here in the blue cable. And the blue cables are controlled by these racks here. These racks are actually FPGAs that can drive signals in the microwave frequency, in the microwave range. And driving the signals in the microwave range enables us to control the qubits in the chip. And that's Alice and Bob superconducting qubits, how they work. So that's pretty much how every superconducting qubit work. And I'll tell you a little bit about how Alice and Bob superconducting qubits are different than all others. But just to give you an idea, if you do that, basically you're us, you kind of work here in the chain, so you're building hardware. And to build the entire value chain for the superconducting qubits, you need to buy the fridges, you need to buy the hardware that can control the qubits, so the FPGAs, you need to build the chips. And if you do that, then you have something that looks like a quantum computer, but you still have a huge value chain to distribute it to end users. And all this value chain right now, it's kind of in the open, because basically all the hardware is very much in infancy. The value chain is kind of trying to find its place right now. It's not entirely settled yet. So that's kind of I'm speaking a little bit fast, so please interrupt me if I'm going too fast.
No, just to say I think it's fine, but
okay,
we'll see with people at the end for the question.
Okay.
I know, and we know that is a complex topic.
Sorry, I will slow down, otherwise it's going to be a bit short. So this is kind of the superconducting, not just the superconducting, but the quantum computing landscape in a nutshell. So as I said, there are many players. There's maybe about 20 players right now trying to build quantum computers. We are very fortunate in France because we have 5 startups trying to build quantum computers. So it's a very rich ecosystem. The UK has a couple, Germany has a couple, Spain has at least one. The US also has a couple. And then, as I said, IBM, Google, Microsoft, Amazon are all trying to build quantum computers. They all have very active quantum computers, quantum computing efforts. One question I've been asked in the past is that a lot of money? And I've been asked this question at EPHP, the French hospital system. And quite frankly, if you add the spend in quantum computing over the year, so over 1 year, you probably don't even get to $2 billion, which is probably a fraction of what we spend on health in France. So it's not a lot of money, but it's a lot of promise. And so the question is, what will we be able to do with this quantum computer? And so here I want, as I said, there are not that many algorithms that are relevant for quantum computing. And I want to be really clear why there's not that many algorithms. And it all boils down to, maybe quantum computers are faster in terms of the algorithm complexity, but is the computer actually faster when it comes to world clock time? And so one thing you want to look at very closely is something like the clock speed or the gate time. If you look at the gate time for classical computing, it's blazingly fast, right? Today's computer, the gate time here, it's in picoseconds, right? If you look at the gate time for quantum computing, here it's in nanoseconds, or even for some technologies, it's in microseconds. So if you compare those numbers to those numbers, you can see it's a factor of 1,000 or even 1,000,000 here. And so this computer, these quantum computers, not only are they very hard to build, but they're also very slow. And so what it means that they're slow is if you do a quantum algorithm, and here's an example with a quantum Monte Carlo, which is an algorithm that's been well studied. If you do a quantum algorithm, the quantum Monte Carlo is known to have a quadratic speedup. And so you can see the classical algorithm, it has billion of steps, but the quantum algorithm, it has only 10,000 steps. So you do have the quadratic speedups in terms of number of steps, but the time it takes to do a step here is multiplied by more than the number of steps has been reduced. And so all the quantum advantage is eaten away by the slowness of the quantum computer. And so what it means is if you actually want the quantum advantage, if you want the quantum speedup, you need to have an algorithm that promises more than a quadratic speedup or any kind of polynomial speedup. You really want an exponential speedup, a super polynomial speedup. And we know there are quantum algorithms that give you super polynomial speedup. So I talked a little bit about cryptography. I talked about chemistry. There are a couple more. So they exist. There aren't that many. And one thing they have in common is they all require fairly deep executions, fairly deep circuits. So for example, if you want to run Shor, which is a factorization algorithm, if you want to run it on 600 bits, on n bits, then your circuit is going to be actually 1200 bits. It's twice the number of bits you want to factorize. But the depth of the circuit is going to be n to the cube. And so if the depth of the circuit is n to the cube and the width of the circuit is n, it means that you need to have very, very few errors, like n to the minus 4. And so if you want to factorize 2048, RSA 2048, which is that's 10 to the 3.3, I think, it means that you need an error rate, which is 10 to the minus 12. So you need an error rate on your qubit that's 10 to the minus 12. And there is no qubit that's been demonstrated that can get you to 10 to the minus 12. And the best qubits today is have 10 to the minus 3. So we need to find a factor of 1,000,000,000 in terms of qubit quality to be able to do anything useful with a quantum computer. And that's here we are switching from what is quantum computing to a discussion which is more like what is Alice and Bob thinking about quantum computing. And here we have this very strong conviction as Alice and Bob that to do anything useful in quantum, you need very high quality qubits. As you can see here, the fidelity, the lifetime, which is closely related to the error rate of different qubits, is really reaching a plateau. It was really improving, and now it's reached a plateau. And also here, the fidelity of 2-qubit gates is also reaching a plateau. And you can see here, we are not even at 3 nines, right? We are at 2 nines. So we are very, very far to 12 nines. And as I said, there are two kinds of errors you can do in quantum computing on a qubit. You can do the bit flip and the phase flip. And the nice thing about cat qubits is, I'm going to say it very, without enough nuance, I'm sure, but the cat qubits, they don't do bit flips. The cat qubits, their main error source is phase flips. And that's very important because really the only way to get to 10 to the minus 12 is to do error correction. If you do error correction on a qubit, which can have errors in two directions, you need to correct errors in two directions. So roughly, it's very well understood, but you need an error correction code that scales as a square. So basically, if you want to get to 10 to the minus 12 for one qubit, really what you need is 1,000 qubits working together to get you one error-corrected qubit, which we call typically a logical qubit. Because the cat qubits, they only do bit flips, you don't need error corrections in two dimensions. You can only do error correction in one dimension. And so that means you can get to the performance required to break RSA, not with 22,000 million qubits, 22 million qubits, but only with 300,000 physical qubits. 300,000 physical qubits is still a big number, but it's 60 times smaller than this one. And actually, or depending on which figure of merit you look at, the one cat qubit is as good as about 60 of Google's qubit, or 50 in this case. And the cat qubit is so promising as a building block for a quantum computer that Amazon has decided to basically copy the roadmap. And an Amazon roadmap towards quantum computing, that's pretty much our roadmap. They published it and they quoted extensively, and they explained how cat qubits are going to enable them to build a quantum computer. So that's Alice and Bob Technical Edge. It's Taylor and Ralph during the CZIT working on the cat qubit and realizing, holy shit, this thing actually works. And all this thing, holy shit, we can actually build a quantum computer out of it. And so the first step towards proving that we can build a quantum computer out of it is to prove that we can get to error correction. And nobody yet has exposed an error-corrected qubit. The closest that people have come to it is Google. Google has come very close to publishing an error-corrected qubit. And some other groups are working on error correction, but we want to be the first to expose an error correcting qubit, hopefully in the next coming months, and hopefully accessible in the cloud. So that's our technical edge. That's what we want to demonstrate in the short term for Alice and Bob. If we do so, it's Nobel Prize physics level, not for people at Alice and Bob, but for the people who actually invented the technology 15 or 20 years ago. So that's something we're very proud of. Hopefully it will work. Some use cases, I've been talking a little bit about these algorithms and how they can transform the world. I wanted to be a bit more specific. Optimization, so any kind of use cases like logistics, or chemistry, Hamiltonian simulation. Those are the first use cases we will likely get to. You only need a couple of hundreds of physical qubits to get there, and the depth is manageable. So these are the algorithm we're most likely to see first. Those algorithms here, HHL, it's everything related to matrix manipulation. So that means anything around electromagnetic simulation, civil engineering, machine learning. That's probably a little bit later. And quite frankly, the cryptographic use case, that's much later. I'm telling everyone who wants to be scared of quantum for cryptography that it may be a little bit early to panic. We are already exploring these use cases. We're exploring how maybe we can use HHL for radar simulation. We're exploring how cat qubits can be used to break Shor. We actually have started a consulting unit because basically the situation is the following. Quantum computing has a potential to be truly transformational for some industries. But it's very hard to gauge for a given industry or a given company when will this transformation actually happen. And so to do that properly, it requires a lot of expertise. And so we started engaging with prospects and future customers in terms of, what are the problems that you have that you are not solving or not solving well that you could solve better with quantum computing? And those problems, how big are they? And given how big they are, which algorithms can we actually use to solve them? And given the algorithms and the size of the problems, well, on which machines can they run first? And that's kind of a journey we're taking our customers on, which is these algorithms, they don't exist yet. I mean, they exist mostly in the head of quantum computing researchers, which are a very rare breed. But it's now the time maybe to start thinking about these algorithms and understand how expensive they are, how they can be simulated, how they can be executed. And so that's a type of engagement we are already moving forward with customers. And I won't say more than that because I'm not here to do a sales pitch. But just so you know, just because the machines are not here already, doesn't mean there is not already a lot of engagements around quantum computing. I'm really speaking too fast, so I feel like I really blazed through this, which is not very good. But I'm kind of at the end of the talk, so I'm hoping there are more questions that can maybe enable me to dive deeper in a topic maybe I broached too fast on.
No, I think no, but yes, we have a few questions. I will ask this question and then I will tell you my question on that.
Okay.
Thank you so much for this impressive presentation. So the first question we have is about the error rate. How does the error rate compare to a classic computer?
Oh, that hurts. So it depends which components you look at in the classical computer. So if you look, the most fragile component for bits in a classical computer is a DRAM, so the external RAM. And the DRAM in a classical computer, it's typically just a capacitor which discharges and has to be read and recharged every couple of nanoseconds. And this DRAM is very fragile, and typically DRAMs are error corrected because they're so fragile. Mm. But the error rate within the processor itself, within the computer, it's 10 to the minus 30 or something like that. It's basically no errors. And wherever the computer is known to be fragile, so typically DRAM, it's error corrected. And zero correction algorithms in classical computing are very well understood, very well known, very efficient. One thing about error correction in quantum world, so what you want to do in error correction in the classical world is you basically read the message you received, mm-hmm. and then you project it to the actual code space, right? And so at some point you read the message, right? The thing about quantum computing is you cannot read the information. If you read the information, you destroy it. So all the quantum, the error correction algorithm in quantum computing, they have to dance around this idea that you cannot read messages. So the only thing you can read is parity. And so it makes error correction codes very, very, very heavy and efficient. Error correction, error rates and error corrections are a big topic in quantum.
Mm-hmm. Is it the main challenge?
So I gave you the Alice and Bob point of view, right? So yep. As I said, the potential for quantum computing, it's been understood for 25 years now. The Shor algorithm was invented in 1995. And as soon as Shor's algorithm was invented, lots of people wanted to build a quantum computer. And so people have understood this idea that qubits are fragile for a long, long time. Hmm. And so people knowing that qubits are fragile, there were two reactions. One is the ones I just walked you through, which is, okay, how do we correct for this fragility? And the other one, which is still favored heavily in the industry, is can we build algorithms that would be noise resilient? And this approach is called noise intermediate scale quantum computing. And lots of people are trying to build algorithms in the NISQ era. So algorithms that works with qubits that have an error rate of 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. And these algorithms exist in theory. They have names like variational quantum algorithm solver or QAOA, which is quantum something, I don't know. They tend to be, you can think of them, if you've done machine learning, you can think of them pretty much as a gradient descent. So they have a quantum phase and a classical phase. So you execute the quantum phase, it gives you a state, and you use that state, you decode it, and you use it to inform the next iteration of your algorithm. Mm-hmm. And these algorithms, they work in theory, and they've been implemented on actual hardware, and none of them has yielded what you could call a quantum advantage. And there is a lot of research right now going back and forth, trying to determine, okay, but what kind of noise level is acceptable for an NISQ algorithm to actually work? And does is that noise level even on anybody's roadmap? And right now, the thinking, from what we can say at Eisenbach, from our point of view, is it's NISQ looks a little bit like a dead end, which is too bad in a way, because NISQ has been used as a major funder, major motivation for a lot of quantum computing startups. For example, I mean, a lot of IBM's early effort was around NISQ, for example. Something for Google, a lot of their effort was on NISQ. Right now, not many people can, at least around Eisenbach, not many people can say that there's still a lot of future for NISQ. If you talk to people who work in more NISQ-oriented companies, they will tell you the opposite. So I don't want to be too biased here.
Okay, thank you, Blaise. Another question from Guillaume, which is pretty close to my question about the future for the quantum computing. So today, what are the different type of quantum computer build / available?
Yep. So you can... You can
leave I just finished my question. And what are the real world problems that they can solve effectively if they do so today? My question is more for today than for the future, please.
Yep, happy to answer this one. My answer is going to start in the same way as the answer to Didier's question as it was first asked. But basically, you can divide quantum computer types in several types. In terms of the algorithms they can run, right? And I've been talking about NISQ, and I've been talking about Eisenbach approach, and those algorithms, those quantum computers are what you would call gate-based. So Eisenbach approach is called Fortran quantum. But both NISQ and Fortran quantum, they're both gate-based. So you can think of what they do as execution of a circuit. And there are many computers that you can access today that can execute circuits, but none of them will give you a quantum advantage yet. And then there's another class of quantum computers which are not gate-based, which you could think of as analog quantum computers. So in the same way that we used to have analog computers, they were used to compute tides or to compute cannon trajectory, bullet trajectories, stuff like that, or to compute navigation system for the Navy and stuff like that. So we used to have analog systems, right? People don't remember, maybe. But we used to have analog system. And what analog system did is that they did one type of computation very well, but only that particular type of computation. And similarly, in quantum, we also have analog systems. So you can think of Pascal's machine, for example, as an analog computer. And these analog systems are very good at finding minimums. So if you can express your quantum problem, or your problem in general, as a problem that you need to find a minimum for, these analog systems are very good. And some of them are very close to beating the state of the art that you can do with classical systems. So they may be closer to quantum advantage than the gate-based system. The thing is, they are very limited in the type of algorithms they can run. Does that answer your question, Guillaume?
Yes, thank you. The second kind you cite, like analog one, is that the one that are called simulation? Or...
Yep. So in quantum, we have this naming issue. We have two kinds of simulation. One is simulating a quantum computer in classical computing. And so now we don't call this simulation anymore, we call that emulation.
Okay.
And so you can take any, if you have a small number of qubits like 10 or 20 or 30, and you want to do a computation with these qubits, you can actually emulate in a classical computer that system. And this emulation will break because of a memory requirement around 40 qubits. So we know that to get to quantum advantage, you need more than 40 qubits because anything under 40 can be emulated. And that's different from what you just said, Guillaume. And I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands that, which is simulation, which is using qubits to simulate a problem or a physical system. And that's kind of the analog computer indeed. So that's quantum simulator. And the French startup Pascal is very good at that. There's also an American startup called D-Wave, which has a simulator. And all these companies are claiming they are very, very close to the quantum advantage on the one kind of problems they can treat.
Good. Florian, would you like to ask your question directly?
I can try. Let me check. I asked two of them, actually. The first one was about latest algorithm that are, I think I remember about a competition finding for the best algorithm for post-quantum computing. Yeah. And is that the kind of thing you can run currently on a quantum machine?
So post-quantum is quite an interesting topic. So the idea of post-quantum computing, post-quantum cryptography, actually, PQC stands for post-quantum cryptography. And the idea of post-quantum cryptography is, so Blaise has told us there is no quantum computer that can break crypto yet, and that's true. But, you know, there might be in the future, maybe 10 years, 15 years, 20 years from now, there will be a quantum computer that can break cryptography. And what if a foreign country steals all my secrets now in a encrypted manner, and 10 years from now acquires a quantum computer and decrypts them 20 years from now? I'm still fucked, right? If the secrets are very important, I'm still fucked. This attack is called Stornad Decrypt Letter, SDNL, and that's the topic of post-quantum cryptography. So if you want to protect against SDNL, Stornad Decrypt Letter, you want to encrypt your data with an encryption scheme that is known to be resistant to quantum attack. And in that spirit, there's a lot of research right now on PQC cryptographic algorithms. So algorithms that are resistant to quantum attacks. And there is indeed a competition going on right now that's organized by NIST, a US body, to find the best post-PQC algorithm. And in a way, we are not in disgrace at all, Alice and Bob. PQC is very much a not quantum topic. It's very much a cryptographic topic. There are very, very good research going on right now, especially in some French groups, actually in Brittany, Netherlands is a very good group on that. But it's not quantum per se, it's post-quantum.
Yes, if I'm not mistaken, it's a developing algorithm for classical computing that will resist the potential computing advantage that will come perhaps in the future.
That's exactly it. They're writing classical algorithms that will resist quantum attacks.
And for same for my knowledge, only to my knowledge, the way you can use quantum system to do cryptography today to share keys is already existing. It's about optical quantum key sharing.
Yep.
It's just to share key between entities. So this exists, but it's another way to share keys than RSA or decryptors.
Exactly, that's a very good point. You can use quantum properties of matter to build a communication channel that cannot be intercepted. So I won't go into that at all, because that's not what we do at all at the Eisenbab. It's not quantum computing, it's quantum communication.
It's another field.
There are very good companies in France that have quantum communication offerings. Vericloud is one of them that just raised, I think, 3 or 9 million to get their offer on the ground. The Chinese state has demonstrated amazing results quantum key distribution. It's called quantum key distribution. They managed to distribute a quantum key over satellite. So the quantum state travels over a satellite and comes back on Earth. It's fucking amazing. And I know there are already commercial development of this technology. Contrary to classical cryptography, quantum key distribution, it's probably not hackable. Like, there is no physical way you can hack into it. So it's a very interesting technology. It's something different from what we do, but it's also very promising.
Cool. We already are out of time, but I would say maybe a last question. So maybe Muta or Flo?
For me, it was already answered. Thank you.
Cool. So Flo, your last question?
Yeah. I was curious about how do you program those computers? Is there a language or something?
So it's kind of funny because, as I said, the hardware is very much not ready yet for anything. And so if you think about programming a classical computer, when you write your Python code compared to what's happening at the physical level, you are going to two, three, or four abstraction level, right? Your Python code is interpreted or it's compiled, and then the compilation, maybe it's transformed into assembly, and then the assembly, it's transformed into, you know, physical impulsions and stuff like that. And very much the same thing happens for a quantum QPU, a quantum processing unit. At the highest level, you program it in Python. There are languages that exist, there are several. The most common one is called Qiskit. It's pushed by IBM, but Google has one, Microsoft has one, and that's the highest level language. If you want to have better control of the qubit, then it's a jungle. But at the very high level, it's very well standardized.
Good. So we are at the end of this Beer and Tech. Thank you so much, everyone, for your question, and thank you so much, Blaise, for this presentation. It was really amazing. And what to say? I will see you for the next Beer and Tech in 2 weeks.
I was thank very happy everyone. To be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you again, Blaise. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.